We now move to the prophet Malachi, who's writing about the same time, I think, as Joel. Now, the connections between the concerns of Malachi in this prophecy and the concerns expressed in the book of Nehemiah, which we haven't done, but we've mentioned the name Nehemiah, came over as governor in 445 BC and was there for quite a few years, I don't know how many, 35, 40 years as governor. So, who begins his governorship in the middle of the century. But the apparent ignorance that you see when you read Malachi of Nehemiah's divorce legislation, which you'll find in Nehemiah chapter 13, suggests that Malachi may fit best early in the period of Nehemiah's governorship, which would mean we're talking about the year 440 BC, something like that. But that's a suggestion. Four areas can be named where there are links between the work of Nehemiah as recorded in the book of Nehemiah, because we're moving into history now. This is the period of Herodotus in Greece and Xenophon and so on. So we're into the beginnings of history writing nearly as we would imagine it to be. Whereas prior to that, it's like Homer and it's all legend and myth and drama and poetry and fact all dramatically presented. Well, four areas can be named that link Malachi with Nehemiah. One is his concern for the proper temple sacrifices. You'll see that in Malachi chapter 1, and you'll see it in a couple of places in Nehemiah in chapter 10 and 13. Malachi's interest in tithes, which you'll find when we go through it this morning in chapter 3, verse 8 and the following, and you'll find it in Nehemiah again in chapter 10 and 13. A concern that Malachi has for marriage partners, partnership, marriage and its legislation covering that, and you find that in Malachi chapter 2 and in Nehemiah chapter 11. And both Malachi and Nehemiah object to the way the disadvantaged are being exploited. Though that's a pretty common prophetic theme. Malachi is critical of priests who don't remain faithful to their vocation. We'll see that, chapter 2, verse 4. He's critical, too, of those who are not faithful to their marriage vows. And we haven't seen any of that in the prophets till now, chapter 2. Although the unjust appear to prosper, divine justice, he maintains, will ultimately prevail. And God will not forget those who revere him. And he uses a lovely expression. He calls them God's special possession, privileged possession. The Hebrew you've met, not in the prophets so far, but we've met it earlier, is segula. It's a treasured possession. Let's begin and have a look at the actual text of the prophecy of Malachi. An oracle, the word of Yahweh to Israel by Malachi. Is Malachi his name? We don't know, it could be. But the word malak in Hebrew means messenger. Angel means messenger. So it means messenger or angel, which angel itself just means messenger. Malachi is my messenger. So it may be a general term. Without giving you the name of the person, he's God's messenger, or it may have been his name. I have loved you, says Yahweh. But you say, how have you loved us? Is not Esau Jacob's brother? Don't you love Esau? That's Edom. How can you love us if you love Edom? You know, there's a bit of stuff going on there. Yet, God says, I have loved Jacob, but I have hated Esau. And here we come to a critical understanding of an Aramaic idiom, a Semitic idiom. Hate and love. Love and hate. That's quoted, by the way. Loved Jacob and hated Esau in Romans chapter 9, verse 13. And you'll find it elsewhere. We talk about the wives of Abraham, who was it? He loved Sarah and hated Leah, the two wives of Jacob.
Rachel and
Leah. Rachel and Leah. And we're talking about Abraham, are we?
No.
Good. You're helping me through. Thank you. I need all the help I can get. So the similar phrase is used there. He loved Rachel and hated Leah. Or Sarah, is it?
No.
Right. Forget about it. Whatever it is. One's hated and one's loved. So to hate, to love and hate in English talk about emotions pretty well. To love someone, you know what it means, and to hate is to feel very strong antipathy to them. Feelings has nothing to do with the Aramaic or the Hebrew. To love is to choose. To hate is to not choose. So that's what it means. You remember in the Gospel, Jesus uses it, and it's literally translated into Greek by Luke, unless you hate your father and mother. Well, that's what it means. If you choose to love your father and mother more than me, is the phrase, in other words, more than God, if that's your choice, well, you're not going to really love them because you're loving them but not loving in them the sacred. You're not actually penetrating to the depths of the person, your mother or father or wife or child or husband or whatever, or friend. You're not actually loving them because they're a sacred expression of God. If you don't love God first, there isn't God and your wife or husband. You don't have God and anything. God is the heart and the beyond of everything. So God is the sacred matrix. God is the personal presence that is bursting in this exploding universe that we've got. So it's only when you get in touch with the heart of reality, which is God, or the heart of your wife or husband or parents, which is God, that you can actually love them properly. Do you get what I'm trying to say? Mm-hmm. Otherwise, the love is surface. It's not getting to the depths. So here, when he says, I loved Jacob, it means I chose Jacob to be the one that of special blessing. I didn't choose Esau. Doesn't mean he felt bad about Esau. I have made his country. Now, this is the logic of their way of looking at things. Because Esau, as now the Arabs have moved in, the Nabataean Arabs, and Esau's been emptied and all that, I've made his hill country a desolation. His heritage is a desert for jackals. Just as God, we just saw in Joel, caused a drought and a locust plague in Judah, we wouldn't agree with that, but that's how they saw it, okay? So, whatever the Nabataean Arabs did in Edom and swept them all before them and made it a mess, that's what God did. So it shows God's not loving them particularly. Are you with me?
Yeah.
I've made his heritage a desert for jackals. If Edom says, we are shattered, but we'll rebuild the ruins, it's obviously what they are saying, Yahweh of hosts says, they may build, but I'll tear down. They're not going to get away with it. Until they are called the wicked country, the people with whom Yahweh is angry forever. Oh, God, that's making Judah feel much better. Because they're their neighbours, they're never going to get a look in. Your own eyes will see this and you'll say, God is great beyond the borders of Israel. You see, we've been through a pretty tough time, but wow, look at all this stuff around us, and he's on our side and he's our God. So cheer up. Can you see why Jesus had to say to his contemporaries, it was said to you of old, love your neighbour but hate your enemy, but I say to you, love your enemies. Can you get the feel of that? So anyone who reads the Bible as though it's all flat and equally true and all from God and all the word of God blank without qualification is in enormous trouble, aren't they? And people who take the Old Testament really, really, really literally, or they can't, of course, but they try to, they're going to end up stupid, mad, hopeless. So we need Jesus and we need the New Testament to bring the flowering of this piecemeal revelation. But God isn't revealing like feeding the chooks. Revelation is being picked up by the insight of people who are open within the limits of their culture, of course. So as they get more and more insight into God, they're purifying, their image of God, but it's still not very pure. And then comes the beautiful Jesus, who's totally pure, and says, this is what God is, and it's very different. So let's move on. A son honours his father. This is chapter 1, verse 6, and then a few other verses. A son honours his father and servants their master. If then I am a father, where is the honour due to me? And if I'm a master, where's the respect due to me, says Yahweh of hosts, to you, O priests, who despise my name? The priests are going on with the incense and whatever they can do, but they're not actually genuine. And now implore the favour of God that he may be gracious to us. The fault is yours, says this prophet. Will he show favour to any of you, says Yahweh of hosts? Oh, that someone among you would shut the temple doors so that you would not kindle fire on my altar in vain. It'd be better to have no religious worship than the phony stuff that's going on, is what he's saying. I have no pleasure in you, says Yahweh of hosts. I will not accept an offering from your hands. For, here's a text we're familiar with, from the rising of the sun to its setting, my name is great among the nations, and in every place incense is offered to my name and a pure offering. For my name is great among the nations, says Yahweh of hosts. I'm offering you three possible interpretations of that striking verse. What's going on there? The simplest understanding would be that he's talking about Jews who are among the nations. So from Babylon and Greece and Egypt and wherever else, Edessa. So the pure offering is being in my name in every place incense is offered, meaning there are Jews, they haven't all come back to Judah, but they're all over the then known world, let's say. Maybe he's talking about them. Another possibility is that he's talking about non-Jews who are in fact worshipping God. That's a big view. If in that case he's saying, okay, you people who are not you Jews, who are not worshipping properly and not genuine in your cult and your religious life, well, there are people worshipping me all over the world. Brackets, they may not know it. They may be talking about Molech or some other, but they're actually worshipping the God. There is only one God. And they're doing it genuinely from within their limits. If he's saying that, that's an extraordinary... We've seen a bit of that in Isaiah, but rarely anywhere else. And here, this big view, perhaps. Thirdly, he might be, this might be an eschatological perspective. In other words, looking for the future, when this will happen. Hence, the Christian church has picked up that text and related it to the Eucharist, right from very early on. That here with the Catholic, the Judaism that has flowered into the universal, all-embracing thing that we know, the Catholic Christianity, because it's what it means, to involve. Okay, that's what it's actually... He's foreseeing, dreaming of, projecting a time when this will be the way things are. And the church picks it up and wants to do that. And Francis of Xavier tears to the ends of the world, to Japan and so on, and to Indonesia, to try and take this message to the ends of the world. So the missionary work of the church, of course, is always continuing. And that's a lovely text that might be picking that up. I can only offer you the three because I can't do more than... I don't know how deep this particular verse in context should be taken. Chapter 2 of Malachi, verse 7 to 9. The lips of the priest should guard knowledge. People should seek instruction from the priest's mouth. That was the priest's job then. For he is the messenger, and the Hebrew word is malak. Malaki, see Malachi. He is the messenger, the priest, of Yahweh of hosts. And Yahweh of hosts means the God of the stars, the God of the heavenly army. But you have turned aside from the way. He's attacking the priests. Heavens. You have turned aside from the way. You've caused many to stumble by your instruction. You've corrupted the covenant of Levi, that's the priestly tribe, says Yahweh of hosts. And so I make you despised and abased before all the people, inasmuch as you've not kept my ways, but have shown partiality in your instruction. It's pretty modern, isn't it, really? And quite complex, really. So you'll have people on the, I'll say right and left, because ever since the French Revolution, that's what we seem to say. So you'll have people on the right claiming that everybody who's trying to connect with people are doing exactly that. They're being partial in their instruction, they're not being faithful to the one Holy Catholic Apostolic Church, you know, and they're not, and we should have Mass in Latin and we should have our back to the people, and, you know, like you'll have all that going on the right. On the left, you'll have people saying all these right-wing ratbags are just burying their head in the sand, and they're not aware where people are, and they're not in touch with the real world, and they're not being faithful to the Vatican Spirit. Do you get me? You'll have all this going on, and then you'll have us. You will, in the middle. We'll be just the perfectly balanced ones. And we'll be thinking, the church has got to somehow embrace all these people, left and right, and the chook has to have two feathers, two wings. So we're trying to, you know, we, aren't we? Okay, so it's complex stuff, and if you're a bishop, you've got a complex job ahead of you to fine-tune things and help people on the right be more humble and gentle and all-embracing, and people on the left to be more, you know, all that. So we've all got to be saints, really. How are you going? Have we not all one Father? Has not one God created us? Why then are we faithless to one another, says Malachi chapter 2, profaning the covenant of our ancestors? Judah has been faithless, and abomination has been committed in Israel and in Jerusalem. For Judah has profaned the sanctuary of Yahweh, which he loves, and has married the daughter of a foreign god. An important line, because it's going to shed a bit of light on the second bit. So he's talking metaphorically, as the prophets often do about marriage. God is the husband, eh? And the people are the wife, we, the bride of Christ, we might say in Christian terms. And we've been unfaithful to Yahweh because we're not living according to the covenant, and we're buying all the pagan values of the Molechs and the Milcoms and the other foreign gods that are all around us. We're not being faithful to our God, our covenant God. You hear that being said there? So that's a metaphor. He moves from the metaphor to this. And there's a connection, but is he moving, is he still talking metaphorically here? I don't think so. I think there's more to it than that, but you'll have to, language is always hard to discern. But he now talks about, having broached the subject of fidelity in a covenant union, he then turns, as does Nehemiah, to the kind of muck-up of marriage that's actually going on in the community. And you don't find this in any other prophet, this statement, so I'll just read it. Because, this is chapter 2, verse 14 to 16, because Yahweh was a witness between you and the wife of your youth, to whom you have been faithless, though she is your companion and your wife by covenant. Surely God made you one. Both flesh and spirit are his. And what does the one God desire? A seed of God. So look to yourselves and don't let anyone be faithless to the wife of his youth. Addressing the men, obviously. For I hate divorce, says Yahweh, the God of Israel, and covering one's garment with violence, says Yahweh of hosts. So take heed to yourselves and don't be faithless. Well, and before Jesus, that's the only statement we've got in the Old Testament scriptures supporting that. Because on the other hand, and it can't be intended to be contradictory, you've got Deuteronomy chapter 24, verse 1 and to the following, and that's a classical text in the Torah about divorce and allowing divorce for whatever. And there were two opinions at the time of Jesus. Now we'll go on a bit. There was the Shammai, the older chief rabbi, let's call him that, who said yes, and it's all male because the whole system was male, because the woman was a possession of the man, really. More than that, obviously, in fact, but in legal terms, that's what she was. So only the men could divorce. There's no question of the women divorcing. And a man could divorce his wife according to Moses, inverted commas, that's Deuteronomy, for adultery, for sexual infidelity. So if a wife did that, then the man could divorce her. Hillel, who was the younger up-and-coming, probably about Jesus' age, I think, rabbi, who was a liberal and a left-winger, he said, you can divorce him for anything that you don't like. Boil the egg wrongly, pst, out. You know? I mean, for any reason whatsoever. And so that was his opinion. So the Jewish men, the women just had to cop it sweet, were arguing about all this stuff when they got together, what are our rights and what aren't our rights. Oh, God, as soon as we get women into leadership in the church, the better. Anyhow, that's what was going on there. And they came up to Jesus. And if you read Mark and read Matthew carefully, they're quite different. But we'll take it in one of them. I think it's Matthew. The question is, Jesus, can a man divorce his wife for any pretext whatever? That's the question that's asked in Matthew. Mark is more general, and it's not in Luke or John. So in other words, do you agree with Hillel? Where do you stand in the current debate about divorce? And Jesus bypasses the whole thing, bypasses the male bit entirely, and he talks about what God's intention is, and he quotes Genesis, because that's what they know. They're arguing from Scripture. So he says this in Genesis and ends up with, as you know, what God has put together, man must not divide, and you know that. But right from the very beginning of the church, obviously there's a problem of when has God put a couple together? I mean, that's the key question. When God has put them together, no one can divide. But you can't work out that God putting them together just on a signature or where the book happens to be or whether it's done here or done there. So you've got this problem from the beginning of the church about, well, how do you sort this out? And Paul's opinion is faith is the key here, and peace. They're the two qualities that he asks, peace and faith. So ever since then you've had so-called, I got a letter yesterday from Melbourne to write and sign or something, but called the Pauline privilege, which is a funny way to talk about it, but it's in favour of the faith. So in the early church you might have a woman who'd become a Christian and her husband was still a raunchy pagan or some bloody thing or whatever, you know, had no intention of, no values sharing. Well, is she trapped in that forever? No, she's not, says Paul. You know, she's got to be free to leave that oppressive relationship because her faith is calling her to something else. So you know all that, don't you? And so there's this complex thing both ways. How do you sort out? And the church is forever dealing with that. And that's what the purpose of annulments is and so on. And I'm not here to talk about that, and it's too complex to do carelessly and briefly. But the question is, we can't assume just because there's a relationship that it must stay. It was like that 100 years ago a bit, because divorce was very rare because texts like this kind of frighten, and texts like the Gospels are there. So people often, because of the strictness of the interpretation, were locked into, some worked their way through the darkness, as you'd all know, and we all have it in our life, and they came to a higher point because they kept faithful. and they worked through the pain of all that and came to a beautiful place. And most marriages are probably like that. But many stayed in a dysfunctional relationship where both were being hurt, and you know that too. So, and that can't be what's meant to be. So there has to be room for interpretation, discernment, peace, and faith are the two things that Paul talks about. He's, God has called us to a life of peace. So if it's not loving and it's not mutually elevating and it's not actually helping the soul, then there can be more important values that have to be chosen. But there's Malachi anyhow. Oh, I'm sorry to have gone on with too much of that, because I should say it more carefully if I'm going to say it at all, but that's the best I can do just now. I'll read it again, because Yahweh was a witness between you and the wife of your youth. So is he talking about... I think it's probably he's talking about marriage, but it's occasioned by that image that he's just used of the marriage between God and his people. Malachi chapter 2. You have wearied Yahweh with your words. Yet you say, how have we wearied him? Answer, by saying, all who do evil are good in the sight of Yahweh. He delights in them. And here again you get a complex thing in the church. You'll have people on one side, not many, thank God. Probably that declares where I am, doesn't it? But anyhow, I'll say over in this right-wing area, you'll have people who say, well, that's what these priests that are getting up in the pulpit and saying, everything's okay, we're all okay, God loves you all, stay a sinner, keep ruining other people's lives, get into drugs, do what you like, it's okay, God's loving. And then people will get up and say, there's no such thing as hell. Couldn't be hell, because God is loving. Hell's got nothing to do with God is loving. This boy's parents are incredibly loving, but he's still living in the gutter because he's left home and doesn't give a damn. He's not going back to his parents. You know what I mean? Don't blame. They may be the most loving parents in the world, but here's the kid. Because love doesn't force or control. So anything, we're free people. Hell is what we do to ourselves, as long as you realise that. But even then, some of the parables of Jesus read carelessly. You get the idea that God's a judge. And one day we're going to come up and God's going to say, right, you, heaven, sheep, goats. And God makes the decision where you go depending on your behaviour. It's not like that at all. It's hell is what the Catechism puts it so clearly, it's a self-determined place. You determine to resist love forever, stubbornly, determinedly, without any sorrow. You just will not submit to this, and you stubbornly create your own hell here. And why would death suddenly wave a magic wand over it? So our life matters, the church is saying. Jesus is saying, he talks about hell a few times, he means it. It's a metaphor, but he's still talking reality. What we do in our life has effects. We can't pretend them away. So it's very important that we take this life that we've got and give it our best shot and allow the purifying action of life to bring our love pure, so that we're really open to the beautiful mystery that God is, and not think it doesn't matter, God's loving, everything be okay no matter what I do, because it just doesn't work like that. So here are people saying, and some people can be accused of this today too, all who do evil are good in the sight of Yahweh, he delights in everybody the way they are. Well, God does delight in everyone the way you delight in children who might be in a pretty messy place. So God's love is never doubted, but love isn't till you welcome it. So if I stubbornly refuse the love, God will love me forever, but I'll be in hell because I don't want it, won't have it, won't accept it. See, says Malachi 2, I am sending my messenger to prepare the way before me, and the Lord whom you seek will suddenly come to his temple. It's all going to happen pretty quickly, and you can see at the time of Jesus, even Palm Sunday, there's a bit of this echoing. The messenger of the covenant in whom you delight, indeed, he is coming, says Yahweh of hosts. But who can endure the day of his coming? Who can stand when he appears? He's like the refiner's fire, like the fuller's soap. He will sit as the refiner and purifier of silver. He will purify the descendants of Levi. Priests are still center focus. He will refine them like gold and silver until they present offerings to Yahweh in righteousness. Then the offering of Judah and Jerusalem will be pleasing to Yahweh, as in the days of old, as in former years. Then I will draw near to you for judgment. I'll be swift to bear witness against the sorcerers, against the adulterers, against those who swear falsely, against those who oppress the hired workers in their wages. It's got a long tradition of that in the... against the widow and the orphan, against those who thrust aside the alien. Hello? How relevant is that? Who thrust aside the alien, who do not fear me, says Yahweh of hosts. You've spoken harsh words against me, says Yahweh. Yet you say, how have we spoken against you? Obviously, we're in a different style here. We've never met this style before in any of the prophets. And you've said, it's vain to serve God. What do we profit by keeping his command or by going about as mourners before Yahweh of hosts? Now we count the arrogant happy. Evildoers not only prosper, but when they put God to the test, they escape. You're in the book of Job now, aren't you? And a lot of other Ecclesiastes, a lot of this unaccepting the wisdom of the past, thank God, because the wisdom, so-called, of the past was, okay, if you're prospering, God's blessing you. If you're in crook situations, well, God's... And this is not working. Like, you look at the evidence, and they're thinking, hey, there's more to this. So here's all these people prospering, and they're not giving a damn about God. So what the hell are we worried about all this religious claptrap for, they're saying. Then those who revered Yahweh spoke with one another. Yahweh took note and listened. And a book of remembrance. He got one of these angels who's doing bugger all to get a decent job. So he said, come here, write all this down. We're going to get this. So he got a book of remembrance of those who revered Yahweh and thought of his name. They shall be mine, says Yahweh of hosts, my special possession. Here it is again, my segula. On the day when I act, and I will spare them as parents spare their children who serve them. Then, once more, you'll see the difference between the righteous and the wicked. But now it isn't apparent in 5th century Judah, because the wicked seem to be prospering, and that should be something that God's organising, but it seems a bit funny. And the really beautiful people are often desperate and poor, so it's not adding up. So their theology isn't working. They have to rethink it all. But you'll know the difference, says the prophet, between one who serves God and one who doesn't serve him. And the concluding editorials, chapter 4, verses 1 to 6, or if you go to the Hebrew, it's chapter 3, verses 1 to 6. This one, the chapters are all mixed up. Remember the teaching of my servant Moses, the statutes and ordinances that I commanded him at Horeb for all Israel. So go back to the Torah, to the way. That's one thing. And then it concludes, and these are the last words of Malachi, and we have them in the New Testament, as you know. See, I will send you the prophet Elijah. This is a later interpretation put into the text, because he talked about my messenger, Malak, remember that? Mm-hmm. Now he's identifying. The messenger is going to be Elijah. Come back. And that fitted in with people's, what do you call it, their frame of reference. Because Elijah, they had this wonderful story about Elijah who never died, who went up in a fiery chariot. And where is he? He's with God and he's going to come back. So this feeds into that. And you go to in the New Testament, remember that? Often they say, who? And Elijah says, John the Baptist is Elijah. Come back to you. All right. See, I'll send you my prophet Elijah before the great and terrible day of Yahweh comes. Quote, which Luke quotes in chapter 1, verse 17. He will turn the hearts of parents to their children, the hearts of children to their parents, so that I will not come and strike the land with a curse. And the great day, Jesus sees the great day as his ministry coming. And it's about, come to me all you who labour and are burdened. It's about love. It's about healing. It's about forgiveness. It's about an all-embracing world love. It's about the reign of God, which Jesus is always talking about, which means the reign of love right throughout the world for everybody. It's nothing like the fear thing that they were all expecting, but the texts are here and they're reinterpreted in the light of their new experience by the writers of the New Testament.